Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to have you with us this morning. Reminder, Film Week comes your way tomorrow, 11 o'clock, as it does every Friday. We invite you to join us as our critics talk about all the week's new films. We'll also talk efforts to restart Hollywood productions in the time of COVID-19, the state with its new guidelines, but awaiting Los Angeles County with its own measures to try and protect people who are working on productions and at the same time get an industry which has been devastated financially back to work. We turn our attention now, though, to the announcement yesterday of charges against the three police officers who were at the scene along with Derek Chauvin, who was initially charged with third-degree murder in the killing of George Floyd on the streets of Minneapolis. The charge against former officer Chauvin has been upgraded to second-degree murder, and the officers involved have had charges against them for aiding and abetting second-degree murder and second-degree manslaughter. With us is former federal prosecutor Shan Wu, who's based in Washington, D.C. Thank you very much, Mr. Wu. We appreciate your being with us. First of all, can we just talk terms here? What is the difference between second-degree murder and third-degree murder?
Sure. Nice to be with you, Larry. The difference, and these laws vary from state to state, so that's important to remember. It's not a national standard. But in Minnesota, the difference is the following. Third degree, which is what they were originally charged with, does not even require an intent to kill. And so that's going to be an easier charge to prove. Second degree in Minnesota does require an intent, and then beyond that, first also requires premeditation as well. So those are the distinctions. Hardest would be first, a little harder, second, and easiest, third in this situation.
So I've heard some legal analysts argue that the former officer should have been charged with first-degree murder with that premeditation included. What do you think of that opinion? And if he was to be charged with first degree, what would prosecutors have to prove?
So with first degree, the difference between the intent and the premeditation is premeditation typically involves some kind of planning. But what's really important to remember is prosecutors are actually really not aggressive enough with police cases. Contrary to popular belief, they're actually very risk averse, and they're afraid to bring police cases because they're really hard cases to win for a bunch of reasons, including that society and juries tend to want to believe the police when it comes to trial. So you see in that first charge that came out, they're going with something that most ex-prosecutors would say that's an easier charge to prove because there's no intent. Having to form intent and even premeditation isn't as hard as we think it is. Premeditation is not like it is in the movies where there is somebody planning something for a long time with paper and plans. Intent and premeditation can be formed in just a second. And here, as we see on that awful video, there's far more than a second or a few seconds. There's 9 minutes of evidence of that intent and premeditation.
So you think a first-degree charge would be warranted in this case?
I do. And as a former prosecutor, I would want to use the highest charge, most serious charge that the evidence supports, because it also strategically puts a lot more pressure on the defendants to cooperate, perhaps, and that's what you would like to have happen.
So if one of the things that I've heard from legal analysts is that if you charged at first degree, then it's more likely that Mr. Chauvin's legal team would accept a plea for second degree and it wouldn't go to trial. Would that be your thinking?
Yes, it would be. Most criminal cases result in plea bargains, not trials. And you add a lot of pressure, obviously, to somebody hitting them with a first degree. Even more importantly, since we have these other officers who are on the scene who are now also charged as accessories after the fact or during the fact, it puts a lot of pressure on them to cooperate. So sometimes the lead defendant most at stake is not going to easily roll over and take a plea. But as the evidence builds with other officers who are on the scene, if they're also cooperating or they've taken pleas and are giving damaging evidence, that really ramps up the pressure on the lead defendant.
And I'm still a little murky on the difference between premeditation and intent. So in this specific case, we see from the video an apparent wanton disregard for the life of the person and for nearly 9 minutes doing something that obviously has put Mr. Floyd into deep distress. So I understand where you could say there was intent to kill him or to do serious harm, permanent harm to him physically. But premeditation, how can you explain that a little bit more, how it would come into play? Because I think for many of us, we think of that as a racist cop who would go out and say, I'm going to look for a person of color that I'm, you know, going to do harm to tonight. Or this individual who I have some history with, I'm going to mess him up. Something that would not be a just in the moment thing. So can you explain how an in the moment application of premeditation would be made?
Sure. And something that's happening this quickly, it's definitely harder to find that evidence, which is why the cooperation could be helpful. But for example, if during the time that Mr. Floyd was being pinned down, there was conversation that went on between the officers about what was happening, and the person who had the knee, who's actually causing him to die eventually, has time there not only to form the intent to kill him, but is talking and thinking about what to do there and still intending to do that. So it's a subtle nuance, but here's an easier example. Let's say there was a conversation hypothetically and that lead officer said, I don't care about his health. He's talking, I'm going to keep my knee on. I don't care if he dies. Now you have something which is more specific to thinking about and forming the premeditation to kill. The important thing to emphasize for the listeners is that can form so quickly. It doesn't have to be done days before. They don't have to be looking for the person. But just as those 9 minutes can show evidence of the intent to kill because of the length of time, there could also be evidence within that time that's going on that would show the premeditation.
We're talking with former federal prosecutor Shan Wu. We have a second legal expert I'm going to introduce momentarily, but I want to invite you to call in with your questions about the prosecution of the four Minneapolis police officers charged with murder in one case, with aiding and abetting murder and manslaughter in the other three cases. Your questions about the charges and the prosecution. We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. We've got the AirTalk page at kpecc.org. You can ask a question via Twitter at AirTalk or post on the AirTalk Facebook page. With us from the University of Minnesota School of Law, criminal law professor Richard Fraze. Thank you very much, Professor Fraze, for being with us today. Your thoughts about the charging here of second degree instead of third degree, does that make sense to you, or a first degree charge?
Well, as Mr. Wu indicated, third degree is an unintentional killing. Second degree can be either intentional without premeditation or felony murder. Felony murder is where death results while someone's committing a felony, and it has to be, in most jurisdictions, a violent felony. In this case, and I believe, reading the revised complaint, that this is actually being charged as second-degree felony murder, not intentional murder. And that's actually, in some ways, easier to prove than either intentional murder or a third-degree extreme recklessness murder, which was the original charge, because all you have to show is that there was a felony assault in Minnesota that qualifies as a predicate felony for felony murder. And moreover, they kind of hedged their bets. They said that Mr. Floyd lost consciousness, and when that happened, it became third-degree assault, a felony assault. It began arguably as a misdemeanor. misdemeanor assault, pressure on his neck, perhaps intended to cause him to lose consciousness. So there, I think they don't have to show either intent, sudden intent to kill, or extreme recklessness as to death. They just have to show there was a felony assault. And I think that that's probably, it's a broad doctrine in Minnesota, broader than in most states. And the local prosecutors in this case and some previous cases chose not to use that doctrine. But it is available. It is perfectly a legal charge. And I think the Attorney General could still go to a grand jury to get a first-degree premeditated murder charge. That does require a grand jury indictment. These lesser murders, second degree of either type, third degree, can be charged just by the prosecutor on a showing of probable cause. The fact that the Attorney General yesterday did not charge second-degree unpremeditated intent murder signals to me that they may not be intending to go to a grand jury for first degree, but we'll just have to wait and see.
We're talking with Richard Frays, criminal law professor at the University of Minnesota School of Law. If you have questions for our legal experts, we're at 866-893-KPECC. Professor Frays, what about the other three officers accused of aiding and abetting second-degree murder and second-degree manslaughter? What is the degree of challenge, if any, in those prosecutions?
Well, again, I think it would have been a harder case. It would be a harder case to show that they intentionally aided Officer Chauvin in an intent to kill, even a sudden intent to kill. There was no discussion among the officers that I'm aware of that indicates we want this guy to die. But as I said, I think it is inferable and perhaps provable beyond a reasonable doubt that they intended to make him lose consciousness. This is called unconscious neck restraint. And in the in the New York Times this morning, a review of police use of force cases in Minneapolis in the last 5 years, unconscious neck restraint intended to cause unconsciousness was used 44 times by Minneapolis police officers in the last 5 years. So it's pretty easy to infer that that's what all of these officers were intending to do, and the other three officers were helping Chauvin do it. So they are aiding and abetting that assault. And again, once they're all liable for assault, they become liable for murder if the victim dies.
We're talking with University of Minnesota law professor Richard Frays. Professor, do you know, is there officer body cam footage yet to be publicly released? Because I would think if you're going to have multiple angles of something that is so horrible to watch, to show that to a jury would be just extremely difficult for them to sit through.
Right.
And would make it very, very difficult for the defense to counter that sort of imagery.
Absolutely. No, I think it's going to even be hard to find a jury if it goes to trial who hasn't 12 people who haven't seen this horrible video. And the video, it's very, very damaging to the defense here. So that it's going to be hard for them. I guess their best defense might be, we had no idea, even if he lost consciousness and passed out, we had no idea he would die, and we didn't want him to die. So you have to have the argument would be you have to have a reasonable doubt that we were trying to kill him. And the prosecutor says, well, we don't have to show that you wanted to kill him. We have to show that you wanted him to lose consciousness. And then the police say, well, but we have a justification. We have an affirmative defense here of the use of force to subdue somebody we're trying to arrest. But the revised complaint makes it pretty clear that this, even that much force of trying to make him lose consciousness was excessive and unnecessary. And that video reinforces that, but it's in all of the, you mentioned the body cams. I think that there's evidence about the lack of resistance, the things that Floyd was saying that signaled that he was in medical distress, and the officers knew that. I just think that it's going to be a very hard case for the defense.
Shan Wu, former federal prosecutor, we've had a number of listeners ask about the potential for Mr. Floyd and former officer Chauvin knowing each other, because apparently they both work security at the same club or bar. And I don't know the accuracy of that, or whether there's any evidence the two had ever met or knew that they worked at the same place. How might that factor in once we know more about that?
If that evidence emerged that they knew each other previously, that might form the basis for evidence of a premeditation. If there had been bad blood between the two of them before, that could be an issue. Similarly, if they knew each other and the officer knew that he'd worked security in a bar, it makes it even more bizarre that he would be applying this kind of pressure to someone who he had worked with before. So it very much goes to the officer's mindsets there. So that's where that evidence would become significant.
All right. And also, we have two different autopsies, one that was done by the local jurisdiction, the other that was commissioned by the family of Mr. Floyd. And there were some differences in how those reports were written. How does that play here, Mr. Wu?
That's going to be quite a bone of contention. Part of the lack of aggressiveness that prosecutors display in police cases in a death case will be related to that first finding. And if that first finding isn't supportive of a homicide, for example, I believe that first finding talked about some underlying conditions, toxic substances in the blood, that's problematic for them. I doubt that the prosecution is going to simply accept the private autopsy, but it may cause them to revisit the original one, maybe asking for a review of it or a second opinion, because that autopsy report is going to be Exhibit 1 for the defense.
Same question for you, Professor Fraze. How do the autopsies factor into this?
Well, they both agreed that the so-called manner of death was homicide, meaning that this guy didn't die of natural causes by himself. He died because of police action, because of human action. That makes it homicide. It doesn't necessarily make it a criminal homicide. They differ in the manner of death, but the family autopsy, those doctors admitted they didn't have as much information as the medical examiner did. They didn't get to examine all the body parts, it's unclear to what extent the officer's action, the unconsciousness of Mr. Floyd, was that he stopped breathing. I think that what I read of the private autopsy, it seemed as if they were talking more about that horrible video than they were about medical evidence, and saying basically, look at him, he's being strangled, and that actually wasn't what was happening. The knee was on the side of the neck. More likely, the knee was cutting off some blood to the brain, there's going to be argument about that. The defense can certainly introduce it on their own, but the prosecutor, I think, is going to say, "Look, but for this police action, he wouldn't have died, and that's basically for causation. That's all we need. It doesn't really matter whether it's asphyxiation or a cardiac arrest, which is what the full medical report, which has now been made public from the medical examiner, shows."
We're talking with University of Minnesota law professor Richard Fraze and Shan Wu, former federal prosecutor in D.C. He's done a number of police excessive force investigations and led a police corruption task force when he was a federal prosecutor. We'll continue with more of your questions for our legal experts about the prosecution of the four former Minneapolis police officers who've been charged in the death of George Floyd. We'll be back in 1 minute on Air Talk. Good morning. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. A little bit later, we'll be talking about the reopening of Vegas with my counterpart, who hosts the local public affairs show in Vegas on KNPR. He'll be joining us to talk about what is a very big day for many of the employees who'll be able to go back to work in Las Vegas, but of course, amid concerns about their health and the potential spread of COVID-19 in those mega casino resorts on the Las Vegas Strip and elsewhere in Vegas. Right now, we're talking about the charges that have been filed against Officer Derek Chauvin, fired by the Minneapolis Police Department, who was the officer with his knee across the neck of George Floyd, who died while in police custody after nearly 9 minutes of pressure on his neck from the knee by Officer Chauvin. He's being charged with second-degree felony murder. The three other officers who were there with him and who did not intercede on behalf of Mr. Floyd when he was saying that he could not breathe, those officers have been charged with have been charged with aiding and abetting second-degree murder and second-degree manslaughter. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Ralph in Reseda, you're on Air Talk.
Larry, I wonder if your guests would be willing to weigh in on this suggestion or this observation, and that is, and I don't want to convey any sort of sympathy or concern per se for the person who has been charged here. This is apparently a horrific event, and it has become an international focus point, and so be it. But it just strikes me that I think you would agree, even in terms of your show, in the last few years, to the extent that we look at the criminal justice system from the point of view of somebody being prosecuted, it's almost invariably concerns about fairness and whether rights have been respected and whether the process was truly fair to that person and whether there was a rush to judgment and whether new evidence might shed doubt. And in this case, it just seems obvious to me that there is a complete fixation with immediately deciding conclusively that this person is guilty of the most aggravated form of murder imaginable. And, you know, before the professor clarified things, your prior guest was talking about premeditation in this context. I'm a lawyer here in California. I've handled many cases of this sort. I'd like to hear any case described that had resulted in a first-degree murder conviction under remotely similar facts, unless you're talking about a felony murder theory such as the professor discussed. So I'm just saying that I think, you know, who knows what's fair, but we are looking at this case through a lens totally differently than the Innocence Projects and usually the focus that we hear from the law professors and from the community that expresses such concern about the fairness of criminal justice.
Well, and I think part of that, and I'll let the our experts talk about it, is what critics say are the laws which provide additional protections and presumptions in the legal system, which benefit officers who've been accused of excessive force or being responsible for the death of someone in their custody. So in those cases, what we more typically hear are the arguments that it's harder to prosecute police and that as a result, more difficult to punish extreme behavior by officers. But Shan Wu, former federal prosecutor, you want to respond to what Ralph is saying?
Sure, yeah, a very, very good question. But the real answer to that is for decades, the scale has been tipped the other way, which is it wasn't until a few years ago that awareness grew of just how many citizens are actually killed by police officers and how few are ever prosecuted. So this fixation is not really a fixation. If this was not a police officer, if we had a video of regular civilians doing this to someone, or you had someone shot in broad daylight, there would be just as much feeling of, gosh, this is an obvious murder case. That, in my opinion, as a former prosecutor, is where we've got to go with police cases. There's got to stop having being a double standard for them. They need to be treated just as other citizens in terms of charging decisions. Absolutely harder to prove because they are police officers. They have a right to have a gun. They have a right to shoot. But those initial charging decisions, the views of the jury, those are only going to get changed when we start to bring more cases and treat police just like we treat other citizens.
Professor Richard Fraze, University of Minnesota School of Law, your thoughts on Ralph, our attorney caller's question.
Well, it is going to be a challenge to give these officers a fair trial, starting with how do you get a fair jury? And if we're going to move the trial outside of Minneapolis, which is sometimes done to try to get away from the publicity, but of course this is national and international publicity, but maybe you can get more fair-minded jurors outside of the city, but that means you probably have a less diverse jury, more likely to be mostly or all white. So that's a problem. It's, you know, the presumption of innocence and proof beyond a reasonable doubt are fundamental to our system. They represent a policy judgment that it's better to err on the side of less conviction and punishment rather than too much, because too much is an abuse of government power. And so that's what proof beyond a reasonable doubt requires. But how do we actually make it work, especially in a system where if the system is working correctly, most of the people that are brought to trial are guilty. And yet we have to set that aside and say, no, we're going to start at zero and assume nothing and prove this all beyond a reasonable doubt. And on top of that, if there's an affirmative defense in Minnesota, such as self-defense or the use of force to arrest, once it's raised, the prosecutor has to disprove that affirmative defense beyond a reasonable doubt.
Given that we've got the video and universal national reaction of abhorrence to what they see as Mr. Floyd is killed, do you really think this is going to go to trial, or do you think that all four of the officers are instead likely to settle for a plea here?
Well, they're certainly more likely to plead guilty now that there's a second-degree felony murder charge, because I just think that the law is settled. It may be overbroad. It may be that we should revise our felony murder rules, but those are the rules we have right now. So I think that third degree, there were not only greater abilities to raise reasonable doubt, but some legal issues that are floating around on the scope and application of that particular statute. I think it's quite possible, for example, that the officers or most of them will plead guilty to third degree, and the prosecutors say, okay, that's enough. Although I have a feeling they're going to say, no, you got to plead guilty to second degree. It's just, we just want that on the record.
Shan Wu, just real quickly, because I need to close. Do you think that there's likely to be guilty pleas here?
Yes. As the professor pointed out, I think that is likely, because most cases do resolve in guilty pleas. And I think, again, it's a great example. I think we're both in agreement that because there's been a higher charge now leveled at the officers, they're more likely to want to plead guilty to something lower, because that's the way that you strategize as a prosecutor, is you want to force cooperation, you want to force those guilty pleas. Playing it safe does not always succeed.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. That's Shan Wu, former federal prosecutor, and Richard Fraze, a professor at the University of Minnesota School of Law, criminal law, his specialty there. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up, a big day in Las Vegas as some of the casino resort properties are reopening their doors with some new restrictions in place. It's not a universal reopening of the city, but certainly some good news for employees who have been sidelined for so long. They're leading to one of, if not the top, unemployment rate in the country. But those employees returning to work are going to be facing health risks from COVID-19. We'll talk about all of that when we come back on Air Talk in 90 seconds.